Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
This NFL season, all FanDuel customers can bet $5 and get 3 weeks of NFL Sunday Ticket from YouTube and YouTube TV. So if you've got a hunch, you can watch it come to life live. 21 plus and present in Illinois. Offer ends 9/22/24. After 3 week free trial, the full price of NFL Sunday Ticket will be automatically charged seasonal. Cancel anytime. No refunds. Terms, restrictions, and embargoes apply. YouTube TV base plan required to watch YouTube TV. Redemption requires a Google account and current form of payment. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Heretics. Today it's Nuria Khan on the show. We only recorded this yesterday. Usually there's a bit of a 2 or 3 week grace period. What's a grace period? Don't even know. But she is, well, what it was that there's a bunch of reasons that aren't that interesting as to why I've had to bring this one forward and push one or two back. But next should be Aaron Smith-Levin, I'm hoping, on Monday, if we can get round to editing and downloading and all of those things. Nuria has a YouTube channel called The Holy Humanist, or just Holy Humanist, and she's brilliant. I came across her recently. She's amazing at talking about the dogma of Islam, Islamism, human rights, freedom, oppression, and the surrounding conversation about the way that, well, I think it's being called Islamo-leftism, or the sort of unholy alliance of the far left or the woke left with far right aspects of Islamism. And they sort of agree about things like anti-democracy and silencing one's opposition. And it's quite scary, really. She has a frightening tale to tell as well. So we'll get into the politics at first of it all, and then into her personal story around halfway through, involving a scary time in Saudi Arabia. I hope you find this of interest, and please do share this around with friends who need to hear this, I hope. And I will see you at the end.
What is it about Islam that is so attractive to the West, particularly part of the woke left at the moment?
I guess Islam offers that, obviously, that counter kind of contrarian landscape, if you will, like almost an answer to the world's problems that is very much anti-Western. So again, I think that's why a lot of the, you know, the woke or the left are lapping it up, in the sense that they've got this common enemy, which is the current status quo and Western liberal democracies as they are. And we've seen this alliance, you know, happen time and time again. And it's obviously, their agenda is going to reach a point where it's no longer mutually beneficial. And it's not the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So yeah, I'm waiting till we kind of reach that point where of no return, when, you know, people understand who it is that they are supporting consciously or unconsciously in this effort to kind of push back against what they think is the ills of our society or Western society at large.
That's so interesting, actually, because you got me thinking about, someone was saying recently, the left has really moved away from democracy now. It's really moved away from liberalism. And so I suppose it was natural it would move towards any kind of authoritarian, religious, right-wing kind of, something we would associate with the right formally.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, Islam is pretty much as far right as you can get in that sense. So again, it's murky waters, because what people think are, you know, that they're siding with, let's say, a minority or an oppressed people or a religion that needs protection. Islam, you can't really give it those same kind of excuses, because it's not just a religion. It's not just people who you're siding with to defend a set of their beliefs, or you think that, you know, their cultural way or their way of living should also be as accepted in the current, like in a democracy like here in the UK. Islam is more than that. And Islam seeks to take over and control every aspect of an individual's life, and then political life, social life, economic life. It's got a solution to all of those things. You end up very much in the complete totalitarian far right sphere of things. And that is the worry with Islam. It's even if it's kind of not, you know, showed its face in the scariest manner, it is dormant, but it's always lurking. It's always lurking to push further and kind of take more away. And a lot of the time that's happening on so many different fronts, whether it's politically, whether it's on an individual level, but there is a goal to further this and to destroy and break down Western civilization as we know it. It's a perpetual state of mind. It's a perpetual war.
Wow. Is there a way, is there a concern that by talking about this, we're being, I don't like the word Islamophobic, but some people are talking about anti-Muslim bigotry and things like that. Is that a concern at all? Do we sometimes venture into that when we show too much concern about the extremes of Islam?
I think definitely what we need to do is not put those two terms together and not conflate them, because anti-Muslim bigotry, especially here in the UK, it does exist. And it's very much a thing that we need to vocalize and talk about and acknowledge. And, you know, it's not something that we can just, Islam is not something where Muslims or anti-Muslim bigotry is the baby that can be chucked out with the bathwater kind of thing. You have to take any critique of Islam, we need to make sure it's protected from getting the anti-Muslim bigotry kind of confusion spilled over and vice versa. If we are critiquing Islam as a set of ideals, as an ideology, we are not critiquing the actual, you know, believers of this ideology. I actually look at them almost as victims of Islam themselves, especially the ones who are more moderate or liberal or really genuinely do not have any idea the depths of what their religion, so to speak, demands from them. And it's the ones who are more real and authentic, the people who take it literally, or the jihadis, or the imams, or the sheikhs in mosques who are, you know, messing with people's minds through the sermons or their narrative. They know what they're doing. So when we're calling out Islam for exactly what it fundamentally says to do, we might be completely countering what some imams or scholars and those people are saying, but that is very much still critique of the ideology itself and not the people. I've been saying that since my first video altogether, because this is a very dangerous area to be an activist in, obviously, not just with the threats of death looming, but to always, I mean, I come from a Muslim background where my own family is still Muslim. Many of them are at least culturally Muslim still. They're on varying spectrums of belief there, or actual, you know, devoutness. But I could, if you start thinking of it in terms of anti-Muslim bigotry, then any policy that's aimed to counter Islam or Muslims would affect them as well. So it would be, we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we don't acknowledge that Muslims should also be protected in the same way anyone else should be. But their actual ideas and the things that they hold to be true are very much up for debate.
And what, this is the question I think people always want to know, is what, to what extent are Muslims in the UK, in the US as well, in the West, ideologically captured to an extreme amount, or should we, what percentage should we be worried about? And is there such a thing as just a very moderate, nice, relaxed Muslim person?
Surprisingly, there is. I've met many of them. I know many of them, thankfully. And again, it comes down to a lack of wanting to engage or connect with their faith on that level. So they're kind of immune to, you know, what Islam actually says or ask for them. But then again, they are in a state of cognitive dissonance, because when we see a terrorist attack, let's say even when 9/11 happened, I wonder how they are still maintaining to see all the tragedies that Islam brings with it and everything it's doing around the world and still hold on to that belief. But there is absolutely, I think in the UK, we do have a problem, as if we see that in the rest of Europe as well, playing out, where we need to tackle extremism. We have second generation, third generation Brits who are closer to their religion than the first generation of their family that might have come here. And instead of seeing us get more and more assimilated and, you know, like take on British values or kind of feel part of Britain, you see them at loggerheads with that, and you see them holding on to like an iota of an identity, which very much Muslim identity trumps any kind of other identity that you might hold to be true, because you have to love Islam first and you have to outwardly show your Muslim identity first. So if there are second, third generation Brits who are going to read Friday prayers at the mosques, or going to universities and joining ISOC, the Islamic societies, and they are coming out completely radicalized or with extreme views that are fundamentally dangerous. You're going to university, you've got gay students around you, you know, you're studying with Jews, you're studying with all kinds of people who your religion tells you to fundamentally hate. So I have mentioned this before, but I do think in terms of assimilation, it's not been undertaken as a project that's sustainable in the UK. And we're seeing the backlash of that now. We're having, you know, every day you turn on the news, there is something where we're having to fight against Islamism or look at the law or look at definitions, and all of this jazz is going on to contain what has been left to manifest for so long.
Why do we have this issue? Maybe it's a more complex answer than I'm even imagining, but with Islam and not, say, Hinduism, Sikhism, or the Hindus and Sikhs in this country?
I think fundamentally, again, this is why Islam is the most dangerous beast, because it hasn't gone through this watering down phase. It's the youngest of the Abrahamic faiths, and it very much, like I said, it's got political, imperialistic elements to it, which is fundamental to its core. So like other religions, even Hinduism, I think there's a branch within Hinduism that allows you to be Gnostic, they say, which is basically almost atheist within and still be within the fold. Islam is literally be in or die. So that's the way it treats dissenters. So you can already imagine that the power behind the scripture and then the claims. I love it when Hitchin says Islam makes really, really big claims for itself, because it's true. It says that not only is the Quran a divinely inspired word of God, it is literally verbatim the word of God. Mm-hmm. And this is the final message, and Muhammad was the final prophet. So all this finality and all of this lack of room for maneuvering or reformation or all of that is keeping it stagnant. And that's what makes it so dangerous, because the beliefs in there are inherently dangerous. And then the lack of room for interpretation or growth or evolution makes it that much more dangerous.
It's so frustrating, this. I also talk about things like trans on this channel, and sometimes people are saying, oh, you know, they might accuse me of being bigoted or whatever it might be. But the fundamental message that I think I want to get out, and I think you probably do from what you've said, is like, do your thing, you know, whether it's trans, whether it's another sort of woke thing, whether it's being Muslim, Jewish, Christian, whatever. And it's when it becomes authoritarian and it's like starting to impact on other people, starting to take away their freedoms, that's when it becomes like, hang on, okay, there's some authoritarianism here. And that's where the bigotry lies, I think. I heard you on Seth Andrews saying there are Sharia courts in UK cities. That would be an example, I suppose, of sort of pushing certain beliefs on a population of people who don't necessarily want that. Is that actually going on, or is that, to what extent? Because I wouldn't see it. I don't know. What does that look like? What's happening?
So there's instances, for example, if you look at a number of, let's say, law firms in the UK who specialize in Islamic law or things like that, they have Islamic law as a department. Mm. What happens behind closed doors in those communities is that if you're, let's say, if you're a woman and you're trying to get a divorce, your community, the people around you, the people in your mosque, everybody, first of all, they're going to tell you a million reasons why you shouldn't get divorced and to be patient and to stay and all that jazz. But then what they're going to do is essentially maneuver you to not give you access or, excuse me, not tell you that, you know, going through the normal law or going through the normal court system is actually beneficial to you or will give you a lot more control. And so these women, a lot of women are pressured to go to these kind of Sharia tribunals, whether they're set up in mosques or the leader of the community, so the imam. Let's say if we take really kind of hot pockets of like areas in the UK, which, you know, there's a very big Islamic community like Bradford, let's say, or parts of Manchester as well. There's de facto like a Sharia system where there's the imam who's kind of in charge of that local community, and you're meant to revert your like issues to him, mm. as opposed to going through the court system that's set up here. So that's happening on a large scale, because even when I work in when I'm working in the domestic violence sector, so many women who are seeking Islamic divorce have said they're stuck and they keep having to go back to this imam and he's giving them reasons to stay. Or then we have to give them the option and say, why are you even faffing about with that? There's this whole system that's set up for you here. And then they say, no, but it's way more important to me that I get the Islamic divorce and I go through it that way. But then again, Andrew, if you've got children, custody according to Sharia is straight with the father. Once the child is like 7 years old. And that this is what they're doing in general to keep these family units together deliberately and make sure that the mother can't start a new life with her children, as we can in this country. You know, we can. If anyone needs to get out of a relationship, there are, you know, methods in place to do that. So this is happening in kind of those heavily concentrated Muslim areas, especially where you've got mosques as well, like Finsbury Park Mosque, East London Mosque, all of these connections. There is like a man at the top who will do the weddings, do the divorces, dish out those kind of things in a completely parallel system.
It's amazing how similar everything you described, you could have been talking about the Hasidic Jewish community. When I say that, everyone goes bananas at me. I think especially because I am Jewish, and it's maybe the same for you being from an Islamic family or a Muslim family, you get it even more. People are so angry that you turned on or seem to have turned on a belief system or whatever it might be. Yeah. But they have that same issue. I mean, Stamford Hills, where, I mean, the difference is there just aren't many Hasidic Jews at all in the country. I don't even know. It must be in the tens of thousands, if that. It's such a small number of people. But I've seen the same issues. It's just mad that women who want to leave, they have to go through the Hasidic Jewish kind of community to do so. They're not allowed to keep hold of their kids. And then the other thing is that UK courts find in favor of keeping the kids with the dad because they don't want to get involved and mess around with a religious belief. Does that happen as well with Muslim families at the UK courts? Do you know much about that?
In the situations that I've seen, obviously, they've actually got sought relief through the UK courts, and the UK courts have decided the children are better off with their mother, obviously. Mm. And again, the emphasis here is to have the children be involved with both parents as much as reasonably possible. But there is a lot of pressure, again, for the, not even for them to deal with that custody, but to just reconcile. You reconcile at all costs anyway. They don't want to show you that Muslim families are breaking down or have high divorce rates or, you know, any of these kind of things. Even the word divorce mm-hmm. is such a big, it's brings so much shame. Like it's the last resort. And even this comes all the way back from like threats from God in the Quran and things like that, or Muhammad threatening his wives when they were giving him a hard time for right. very rightful reasons, but they were told to shut up or Allah would give Muhammad better wives than you. So, I mean, the woman is always like really, really downtrodden anyway. And the fact that they don't show them that there's this relief option is because they want to keep them in this bubble where Western society doesn't infiltrate. It's internal policing as well. It's internal reputation guarding. There's a lot of that happening.
With the sort of woke unity with Islam at the moment, does some of that come down to the bigotry of low expectations? Do they see Muslims as lesser people who sometimes have to keep these? And if something bad happens to the daughter of some, you know, and who cares? They're lower people anyway.
I think the bigotry of low expectations does play into it for sure. It's especially this you know, concept of, okay, it's their culture, or, you know, it's Eastern tradition, and who are we to say, and who's to say Western values are even better or superior or more equal or equitable or all of that. That's all up for debate with them. So, yeah, I guess the bigotry of low expectations, but it's important to note that, again, Islam has really, really dark elements to it, where even if you're trying to converse with somebody, let's say, who's not as knowledgeable about Islam, you could sell Islam in a way that it could seem like this is just a beautiful culture, let's say, and let us fast and let us do what it is that we do. And so what? We're only demanding like a mosque and halal shops and this and that. But then, you know, you think that that's all okay, that's guarding their way of life, but then it encroaches and encroaches. And then you get protests like the ones outside Batley Grammar School, where, you know, you realize that it's not just them minding their own business or saying, hey, our values are slightly different, they don't line up with yours, let's just, you know, you do you and we do us. It's not like that. It's actually now having intimidating protests, getting teachers to be away in hiding and having to leave school, get security, all these kind of things, which it's just mad to think if this is coming from people who have a different, slightly different culture that we need to respect, you're bending over backwards to respect a really highly regressive culture that doesn't just seem to even want to coexist, but wants to encroach on yours and, like, you know, relinquish it to history.
I suppose they would say that they are being so tolerant that it sometimes you have to be tolerant of intolerance.
Exactly. And that's almost what's happening here.
And that's when it goes too far, I suppose. There was a really innocuous looking video, because you talk about the security and these kind of clashes that have happened outside of school. And there was one that just seemed like, okay, a guy was eating his lunch. Did you see this? And because some of the Muslim co-workers were fasting, they sort of made him feel guilty and he put his lunch away. And it was just a little innocuous thing, but it was quite scary. Did you see that video?
I did. Yeah, I saw it really briefly. And then I was just reading the comments. But yeah, I exactly. And this is what I mean. This kind of small aggressions or like minor aggressions. This is just somebody who's, you know, trying to have his lunch at a normal day at work. And it's minor aggressions like that eventually when they get power in numbers and when it comes together, then you essentially or effectively have a mob mentality sort of seeing play out in the streets of London. That's what we're seeing play out whenever there's something that, you know, they don't like. Mm. And these microaggressions can turn into macroaggressions very, very quickly. And it is that. It's a case of bending over backwards to cater to us and our needs, and we're the victims and we're marginalized and we're the minority and we need protecting. And even that push for like special pleading that Islam needs extra cotton wool around it than any other religion, even though we've got the Equality Act and we've got protected characteristics and things like they want their own special bit of, you know, added protection. And it's just, it should not fly.
They called him, what was it? Kafir?
Kafir,
which is like, what does that mean? Whole idiot.
It's a pejorative for like your non-believers, your disbelievers, your dirty, you don't, it's very, it's a pejorative and it is used as an insult or a slur.
I see away luggage a lot when I travel. As much as I love its looks, I prefer soft side suitcases and always wished Away made one. Well, guess what? Now they do. This suitcase seriously looks better than any old school soft side suitcases I've seen and is designed to be lighter than others on the market. Soft side comes in 4 of their best-selling sizes and tried and true colours. There is something for everyone in the lineup, 2 carry-on sizes, 2 checked sizes, 4 colours, black, blue, pink, grey. Made from a high-strength nylon, the bag is tear-resistant as well as weather-resistant. I spilled a little bit of coffee on the grey one this morning and can confirm the claim holds up. The bag is soft but not sensitive, super durable, flexible and expandable. Bonus points for the compression pad system that helps you pack it in and the anti-tipping stabilizer that holds the bag steady while expanded, both of which are proprietary to Away. And that's actually my favourite bit. It doesn't sort of wobble this way and that. I absolutely pack mine full, take it everywhere I go. Well, when I'm going on holiday, that is. And no matter what's packed inside, it doesn't seem to tip. You've got to check out the new soft side luggage from Away. Head on over to awaytravel.com/heretics. That's awaytravel.com/heretics to see the new soft side luggage from Away. awaytravel.com/heretics.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Does it make you really angry then when you see like an Owen Jones or like a liberal lefty guy defending something and he believes he's doing it in your honor or like for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It actually makes my blood boil. But again, it's the way that Islam has also managed to, it's kind of alludes back to what you said in the beginning as well, that why is it so appealing? There's other like layers to why Islam can be appealing for people as well. So people who are really looking for some kind of structure or some kind of something to be told almost every minute of every hour of every day what to do, how to think. It offers you a very black and white version of the world. If you're a Muslim, the world is very easy to navigate. It's like the West versus Islam constantly. Jews, America, Israel, your worst enemy. And everything is in that narrative of will Islam dominate or will the West dominate? So your enemies are very clear cut. Your causes are very clear cut. And then people who think that they've been failed by Western culture as well. For example, you know, just to put every ill of Western culture out there, like debauchery or, you know, look at the debates around trans people and look how far the West is slipping. All of those things when they feel the excesses of Western culture have gone too far, Islam offers that, like, you know, really reining that in. And I've seen even like white English women who, you know, suddenly they've had some a number of bad relationships gone wrong with a certain type of man, and then boom, they'll turn to Islam, and they will be saying things to me that I think, wow, this is everything I speak against. When you're saying, I feel so perfect and protected, covered up, and look, men don't look at me, and they will protect my honor and all of this. And it's just mind-boggling to me. But I understand that people have various reasons, and Islam to some level offers a weird comfort or protection or purpose.
Particularly good, I think, like all extreme religions and things, for men. Like men get like all these wives. Like it's the same, you know, all the cults, religions, in Hasidic Judaism as well. It's just all about the man. It's quite extraordinary. Do you have an idea of the sort of percentage of Muslims in the West who hold what you would call dangerous beliefs?
I don't know if I actually have it down to a percentage. But I would say, and again, I don't mean to be an alarmist, but like given what's happening, when I say that I'm third generation myself. And when I say that people around me and of like similar backgrounds and ages, when they hold vastly different viewpoints to me, people I work with or I'm surrounded by, and we've grown up in a very similar environment, or not, because I went to the Middle East for a large portion of my life and then came back. So I was able to see the other side of things, so to speak. But it's alarming to me that they hold views that are hundreds of years backwards, and they are just like kind of getting by in society because their views are just kind of, you know, pushed down. But these are people who will walk around and maybe smile at you and, you know, you'll serve them a coffee or whatever. But when push comes to shove, their views are fundamentally misaligned with you. So even basic things about like whether it's UK foreign policy or who to support in a sports game or little things like that, what choices to protest for and not protest for, who to vote for. In government, like, you know, even when George Galloway has come in, and anybody who was disenfranchised with the way the rhetoric was about Gaza and Palestine, George Galloway was just the pro-Palestine savior. Yeah. And so the entire, again, as I said, very, very easy worldview to adopt. And they have done that. Nobody's willing to maneuver and kind of, you know, say, well, actually, I'm a Muslim, but I'm also British first. And, you know, there's certain British values that I would have to say I would fight for and agree with, even if it means it's tiptoeing on things that I'm supposed to hold true.
You're British. I mean, I can see that means a lot to you. And I relate to that as well, you know, growing up Jewish as well or whatever. And sometimes some of the more extreme, not that many, but some of them are just, it seems like that's their thing first. And that makes, to me, just no sense. We live here. This is my country. I watch England in the football, or, you know, less and less because they're not any.
Yeah.
You know, they just drive me mad. But when they're in the World Cup, I do. You know, and that's all that matters for me. And so is it quite a lonely feeling for you? Like, or was it at least growing up around people who were so not into being, I guess, English first? Or English first sounds horrible because it sounds, sounds like one of those things. But just being British and being proud to be British.
Yeah. Again, even where I'm at now, it's quite isolating, because even now. So back then, obviously, I was pretty much still in the fold, but it was only leaving England. Because imagine, Andrew, when I was like born here and growing up here, I was so surrounded by like a microcosm of the beliefs that I held anyway. So yeah, I was going to an English primary school and I was in London, living in London. Everything looks English and British from the outside. But I basically, mentality-wise, I could have been living, you know, in an Islamic city or what have you. So it's even isolating now, because the more that I've, since I've left Islam, naturally when you leave something like that, a lot of your previous hang-ups or things that Islam told you to, you know, hold true are all gone out the window. So your worldview changes. And naturally, as you said, I'm very proud to be like from here and born here. And I appreciate, you know, just things about this country. And also the fact that it basically saved my life when I was in probably the worst situation of my life. And it's only because of the values and things that the UK stands for. So it, even now, just having a different view on maybe the conflict in the Middle East, or turning away from the mosque and not attending every function that, you know, people around you are going to, I can't speak my mind anymore around those people, and I don't, which is why I have my channel and I do my activism on the side. But they think that I have either gone off the rails or I've been called far right lately just because of my stance that they've not really heard. And this is just me unlearning. I'm just learning all this anti-Semitism that was filled in my head. I'm unlearning all the these fibs I was told about Israel. I'm learning all of this. But in the process of that, I obviously get charged up and I realize how much misinformation I was fed, or lies or conspiracies. And I still see people around me hold on to those beliefs, like wildly hold on to those beliefs. Mm. And I see that they're so clever and they've been educated and they're holding PhDs and epic degrees. And I'm like, but you could be the most smartest person in the world, but when it comes to your worldview, you will remain tunnel vision just because Islam. It's wild.
It's frustrating, isn't it? And also this country, I think, I hope I'm right and not naive in saying this. I know there are racists out there. There are people, I mean, even every day on Twitter, there's a bunch of people saying things about me being Jewish. I'm sure they would say about you being Muslim or from being from a different ethnicity or whatever. I like to think that that's a very small percentage. We see them on Twitter, amplified. But like I always say this, is 1% of men in particular, maybe women as well, are psychopaths. So there's not much you can do about, like, let's get rid of systemic racism. It's like, well, yeah, but one out of every 100 people who's on Twitter is going to just be horrible no matter what you try and teach them or whatever, because that's what they're trying to do. Mm. But I do feel like the vast majority of people are quite welcoming, like really welcoming, especially when they see somebody who's maybe their family or a few generations before has come over and made a go of things and wanted to assimilate. They really want you, and then you end up being part of that and wanting others, and I think we really lift each other up. So I find that really sad. You mentioned your story, so tell me, let's get into that. What's your story? Let's start with your story.
So long story short, but basically, do you want me to start from the top? And like,
I think so.
Yeah,
let's do that.
Okay, so I obviously, as I was explaining just to you briefly, like I would think a nominal Muslim growing up here in London. By nominal, I mean I'm very indoctrinated, but I'm still here and part, like, actually just part of English society. I'm too young to kind of have my own identity at this point. So that flashpoint of being really heavily indoctrinated young, because my granddad was the imam of our local mosque where I lived. So he put a lot of importance on, he was at that stage of his life where it's just dedicated now to religion. Mm. And I was really close to him. So I would go to the mosque with him a lot every day after school. I'd attend Quran classes. And interestingly, they actually gave us a book with the translations, which a lot of Muslims don't get when they first read the Quran, which is troubling. But again, as a 7-8-year-old child, this like old English and these translations aren't really going to seep in. And the Quran anyway is just a terrible read. So
like all the religious books, to be fair.
Yeah, fair. We
had that as well, the Hebrew books, and I got English translations, and it's like, blessed art that, right, I'm finished.
Yeah, honestly, he who sits on his throne, I was like, okay, yeah, well,
get your throne out.
Yeah, exactly. You float around on your throne above water. So I took it really seriously. And then at 9, because of the teachings and what my Quran teacher was telling me, I did decide to wear hijab. Obviously, she said this is the right thing to do at 9 years old anyway. That's like a special year for, you know.
Is that right? 9 is the year.
They encourage you as well. And it's got a lot to do with Muhammad's marriage to Aisha, the child bride. It happened at 9. So just, it's like passed down in Muslim families that 9 you should start taking your religion. Okay.
Is that a known thing that's accepted within Islam that she was 9, because I'm worried about us being Salman Rushdie'd, and I don't want us saying things that they're going, hang on, that's not true, so we're going to come and stab you in the eye.
So I come from a Sunni Islamic background. According to the Sunni tradition, it's the Quran and the Hadith, which you have to hold sacrosanct, basically. The Hadith tells us more about the Prophet and how he lived and how to follow his Sunnah or example. The Hadith, the ones that are considered authentic as can be, graded like very, very sound by Al-Azhar University in Egypt, that hadith verbatim says, it's actually Aisha saying it in her own words, that Muhammad married me when I was 6 years old and consummated the marriage when I was 9 years old. And there's various versions of the hadith which go on to say, you know, she was playing with dolls and all of these things. Now, the attempt at whitewashing this has come from Muslim apologetics, and obviously polemics saying, oh, no, if you look at the Islamic years compared to modern years and all of this kind of thing, she was 17 or 18 minimum at the time. Some say less. So there's constant argument to hide this because it's insanely problematic. It's morally reprehensible if you're meant to follow this man's example, which Muslim men are, supposedly. He's timeless. He's perfect. But yeah, if you want to see it verbatim, Andrew, sunnah.com, just write 9 years old or Aisha, marriage, and it's there.
I have no opinion on that. I'm scared out of my mind. I really am scared.
I don't
scared.
Blame you.
And I know that's the part where I think you can say the stuff, oh, the West has got to, you know, the left and all that. And when you get into the doctrine, because I read that Rushdie book, and my God, what an amazing writer, apart from that horrible scene he shouldn't have written. Well, I don't mean that, obviously, and I shouldn't joke, really, but... it's scary.
Yeah.
It's bloody scary. And I don't want to go down in history on record as having said a thing, even though I will always do it against all the other religions and Scientology and Lord Xenu and all of those things. I wouldn't want to go down on record as having said something about the Muslim God.
You didn't say it. I said it for myself.
Yes. Okay. Go. What's your address? No, don't. How could someone? It just I don't know. But I think enough people are speaking out now that there's defense in numbers to an extent. I mean, I don't know if you saw Yasmin Mohammed on. She's
brilliant.
So good.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've interrupted your story. Go on. So 9 years old, hijab.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So you can tell how seriously I took this. I mean, this was the path to get to heaven. And interestingly, when I talk about these communities, most times behind closed doors is why I always talk against the hijab, even though, you know, it's only because of what it means and the origins of the story. But most families are encouraging their young daughters to wear hijab. In my case, I think because my parents are a bit more liberal and a bit more progressive, they actually thought, you know, why? Like, you're really young, you don't have to. And my grandma didn't want me to wear it for other cultural reasons because she wanted my pool of suitors to be open. So she didn't want me to, you know, write off a man that necessarily didn't want a woman that wore hijab.
Okay.
So it was for those reasons, but I was kind of discouraged. And then eventually, so even in RE classes and stuff, I would demonstrate how to pray. Like, I was very much, you know, overtly like proud of my religion and kind of
religious
the
education, just for non-Brits.
Oh, yes.
So religious education classes at school that we all did.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'd be like, oh, Mimi, I'll demonstrate how we pray. I'll tell you what Allah says. And I'll do a little like Miss Goody Two Shoes for Islam. And then basically what happened was my dad got a job. Like, his job moved him to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And we had no idea what to expect, obviously. But just then, on the brink of that, I started to play a lot more sports and I was kind of like becoming more and more of a tomboy. Is that still acceptable to say?
Yeah, I think so. No, tomboy's fine.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know anymore.
I love that you're more worried about tomboy and I'm worried about what you've said about the Prophet Muhammad.
Priorities.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I started to play sports and obviously it was a bit of a hindrance. It's very impractical. It's dangerous as well because if you've got it tied with a safety pin or something, you know. So my mom wasn't best pleased that that was all happening and she was very, very happy when she was like, you're playing football now, it's dangerous. You know, you need time to take it off. And I was like, yeah, you're right.
Nice though. Yeah. Instead of time to stop playing football.
Exactly. There was also time to stop playing football as well from the elder generation because you have to wear shorts and Muslim women don't wear shorts and things like that. But again, immediate family were like, yeah, football first, hijab later.
Were you good at football?
I was actually pretty good at football.
I know it's a different culture, but did you watch Bend It Like Beckham?
I did.
I watched it again recently.
Really?
It's just, what a film.
Classic, right?
It's so
classic.
Good.
It was so funny. When I went to school in Saudi, because I started playing football more and more, and I guess just because of the English accent, my science teacher actually asked me if I was the actress from Bend It Like Beckham.
What?
And I was like, no, that's a film.
That's insane.
I know.
I don't think you even looked not like her.
I know. I was like,
and she must be considerably older than you.
Yeah. Oh. And I was a lot younger. And anyway, it was weird. But yeah, so then, sorry, I moved to school in, we moved to Saudi Arabia and my hijab had come off and the people I was suddenly surrounded by, I was at a British international school, but it had people from all over the world. Their parents had come on all different types of jobs. So I was exposed for the first time in my life, more than actually going to school in London, to other faiths, other nationalities, other experiences, wow, other religions, in a way that I had never been while I was here.
That's insane.
That is mad to like go to Saudi Arabia and have the most eye-opening international experience, as opposed to London, which is a cosmopolitan city. And I've seen it. I've seen the difference in people who have just been here their whole lives in like one area, one house, one mosque, one community, as opposed to people who have gone and then come back with like their varying, you know, worldviews. But yeah, so going to Saudi really, really changed who I was in terms of like my faith became more and more liberalized as I was going. So I was seeing Wahhabi Islam play out all around me. Up until our school gates, men and we had to wear abayas and we weren't really allowed to be seen with boys. As soon as you got into the school, it was like, could have been in the States, could have been here. It's co-ed. We've got discos. We've got end of year parties. Literally like you're having an experience anywhere that's not Saudi Arabia. So I didn't feel like I had to hold on to being Muslim that much anymore because I'd hear the call to prayer five times a day. Modesty culture is seeped into daily life. You have an Islamic police called the Mutawwa. They're also regulating everything, making sure men are stopping their cars and going to the mosque to pray when it's prayer time. Nice. But then I also saw dark sides, Andrew, like casually after Friday prayer, if there would be beheadings or amputations. So like my dad and my brother would come back from prayer and say, oh, we could have stayed because that's what they said was happening afterwards. And this was casual. And for a young mind like mine, I would just question my parents and say, what is going on here? And they would also say, just this is some Wahhabi extreme version of Islam. This is not what we follow. This is Saudi doing Islam on steroids and they don't know what they're doing. So I just like, I took that for what it is and I will keep planting these little moments of, you know, even driving to Mecca the first time to go up to do pilgrimage because we thought we're so blessed. Who gets moved from London to Saudi so close to God's home that every weekend I could go and do the pilgrimage what people spend their whole lives saving to do?
How long was the drive for you?
40 minutes. Mm. And again, it's Saudi Arabia, you don't drive yourself, you have a driver, you know, all of these things are like, you literally just pop your abaya on and go to God's house. So that was that, you felt a huge sense of like, wow, God has called us close to his home. But driving towards it for the first time as well, and you see there's a Quran bridge basically as you drive, and it says all non-Muslims that way, and then Muslims this way, obviously only Muslims can enter Mecca. And like little things like that again, and you'd hear stories of people trying to sneak in or, you know, then seeing the plight of expats from like normal Western countries who couldn't have basic amenities like having a glass of wine. They would have to be fermenting their own wine and their house in the compound or like fermenting beer or, you know, their lives were very, very difficult. And Saudi Arabia made no kind of, obviously it's a home of Islam supposedly, sure. So it made no like concessions for these people. But I saw women being really, really badly like discriminated against, even non-Muslim women by the Islamic police who would come. My mom was grocery shopping with her friends and they're not Muslim. So they had no reason to cover their head, but they were told, cover your head. Well, you're in a Muslim country. What are you doing? Cover your head. And then some like horrible incidents as well that, you know, I heard of like rape and people getting dragged to the desert and especially non-Muslim women that they were targeted. And they're so afraid to even report it that they would just take a plane home to their country of their home country or their country of origin to just get justice or, you know, heal over there because nothing would happen for them in Saudi.
These are women who've gone on holiday or the tourism holiday. They want to go and check out the pilgrimage to Mecca or something like that. And on the way, they've been sexually molested.
No, these are non-Muslim women who are working in Saudi for various reasons, whether they're teachers at the international schools or they're come over as doctors or they're the wives of somebody else who's been out there to work, things like that. So all of those things were like looming, but then we moved to Dubai and that was like a nice, really, really like good East meets West, like a step ahead of Saudi Arabia, less of the restrictions, more of the West meets East, but you still get all the Islamic holidays and all of that stuff. So I thought this was the perfect mix. This is how Islam should be done, in a country like Dubai. You know, you've got all the amount of tourists coming in, you've got, it's perfect. And you don't take away or relinquish anything from your Islamic faith or culture, so to speak. But then, yeah, again, I was so into the religion that I came back here for university and wanted to study Islamic law. So I did that as well. And I was defending everything that Islamic law says, but I was trying to make sense of it. So even now when I read back my university essays, I see hints of like this questioning feminist, but I also see like, but God did it, but God said so. So there's reasons behind it. And you can tell it's a confused mind. But long story short, then it was only until I went back to Dubai and then I was in a marriage that I really wanted to get out of, because it was abusive on many levels. But before it got physically abusive, I made a plan that I need to get out of here. And when in that country, because there was no way that I was going to be granted a divorce by that man, it was one-sided. There was a really, really like ancient Sharia law that was put on me by the lawyer that he had employed to like nip this in the bud. And I had never heard of such a thing. So I'd just seen the bad elements of Islam in Saudi Arabia and I'd heard things, but I never thought this was directly related to Islam. But when this law called Da'a Zawjiya, it relates to the disobedience of a wife, which is directly from a Quran verse that says, if you fear disobedience, if you merely fear disobedience from your wife, then these are the steps that you take. And this Sharia law has been interpreted by Egyptian courts and Tunisian courts and things like that. So basically answering back can mean mischief, or just the thought of you thinking that I'm going to answer back can be mischief. So imagine somebody who's actively wanting to seek a divorce.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, we'll slap her with this this law. And this law, basically the UAE policeman called me and he said, you must return to your husband's house or we'll arrest you and take you there forcibly. And then you can't leave without his permission. So anytime I'd have to leave the house, I'd need to get permission. Again, it comes back to Islamic guardianship laws, the concept of a mihram, which is like a woman, basically, in Islam. You've never got your own agency. So like, think of like a family tree with every possible male relative that woman will be connected to. If all of your close ones are gone, right, you will be connected to your third uncle twice removed, would be responsible for you before you would be.
Oh my God.
At Purely Elizabeth, we believe that one good choice leads to another. So if you can start as small as, say, a bowl of delicious superfood granola, then surely you can take some deep breaths, go for a walk, get off your phone, or use it to look up a yoga pose or two. Because sometimes all you need is a start to get going and keep going on your journey, whatever that looks like for you. And crunchy granola clusters baked with organic oats and superfoods are a delicious place to start. Find us at a retailer near you or purelyelizabeth.com. Purely Elizabeth. Savor the start.
How do you make a vacation last? How do you hold on to the joy, the clarity, the calm? Easy. You go to Aruba. You'll spend your time relaxing on cool, white sandy beaches and floating in healing blue water. You'll meet locals brimming with gratitude for an island that redefines what a paradise can be. You won't just feel great. You'll feel relaxed, renewed, and ready for life. That's the Aruba effect. Plan your trip at aruba.com.
It's always that. Like, that's what I was saying. It's always like women don't get a good deal out of these cults or religions.
Yeah, exactly. So that blew my mind. And I was like, again, I was thinking from a very UK-centric kind of, how can the law do that? How can a judge, the police even warrant this? It's essentially kidnap.
How were you married to this man? Was it arranged?
It was almost like a sped up marriage. So I was introduced to him from a friend that I went to high school with. And so we were like dating in so much as the way that you can date by being Muslim. Do you know what I mean? So it's very like, you can't date freely or you can't like travel together or you can't really do anything. It's very like managed bits of time together. And then essentially, whether it's Islam or culture or a bit of both, once you reach like 22, 23 years old, it's like a ticking time bomb. You need to tick that. You've done uni now. You've got some semblance of a career. That's the next box. And then it's children. And people start asking questions if you're seen just like hanging out or seen in male company without a real purpose or intent to marry. But my parents were actually moving to Malaysia and they said to me, we can't leave you in Dubai without being married, especially being married in the eyes of God. So it was more like a kind of haphazard, let's get this done before we move. And the only way for me to even, let's say, have him fly out to Malaysia if I was to go out or move with them was to actually be Islamically married.
Right. Okay.
The word Islam in Islam to get married, the contract, it's called a nikah.
Okay.
But it's very, very dark as well because the root word of that is NKH in Arabic, which forms the word. There's no word for marriage. This is actually, it means sexual intercourse. So that contract is essentially a payment, transactional, a father giving his daughter for a certain payment, and now you're able to engage in sexual intercourse and Allah will be okay with it.
That's a French word. They've stolen it. Nikah.
Oh my
Nike
God.
Nike means to have sex.
I didn't even make that connection. Yeah.
Yeah. Ta Nike is la meuf. that woman.
Yeah, yeah,
I never thought either from the other, I never thought that must be that though. That's got to be that.
I don't know etymologically because it's the Arabic Semitic root versus the French root.
But because of the Muslim immigration to France, it must have come in because it's quite a slang term.
God, Andrew, we need to look into it.
Yeah, we should be all linguisty.
Yeah, we should.
That's the next podcast.
Yeah.
Linguists deciphering where language comes from. But that's interesting, the Islamic introduction into France and there are a lot of words that have been taken, you know, and there's always like, I fucked your mum kind of thing. Mm. It would be like, j'ai niqué ta mère or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. So that's interesting. And that's terribly sad that that's what has to happen when you get married.
Yeah, well, the reason I brought that up is because for me, it's so sad. Like even my cousins and everybody who still holds on to Islam, they say they're so excited for this. Nothing in their life can happen unless this nikah is done. Mm. And I'm like, if you understood the actual root and the origins of this, I would much rather you go and get registered or like go to the registry office or, you know, do anything but that. Like, I mean, go to church, have a church ceremony or, you know, have a nice like reception in some manner. But this obsession with, when I say the tick box in culture is like, it's covered by that word, nikah. I have to get my nikah done and then I can travel, I can live my life, I can do everything. Everything is like contingent on that.
Yeah.
And that's all Muslim parents will ever tell you as well. After your nikah, you can live your life, do what you want.
Yeah. We have to be careful with that word in the YouTube censors because it sounds too similar to another word, unfortunately. Hopefully that'll be all right though. I don't mean to compare or not to equate anyone, but Hasidic Judaism is the same thing of, you know, that marriage night, and a lot of them feel like they were basically molested that night.
Yeah.
You know? Really sad. How did you then get out of all of this?
So basically what happened is this law that they had put on me, and I was trying to still go through, I trusted the process even up to this point. So I was trying to ask for a divorce, even like Islam doesn't give a woman like the same rights for divorce as a man is given unilaterally. So Muslim countries that have Sharia at play have now added that the women can seek, it's called a khulla. That's how you seek divorce through the courts. It's quite like the evidential burden of why you want it is pretty high, and it varies from country to country. But I was going down that route. And again, if you go down that route, they make it so tough for women that you have to give up your meher, which is your, basically, it's kind of like the money that you were paid for the N-word. that sounds even worse.
Sorry, I've like censored you into this. Gosh.
No, that's okay. So they were making my life hell anyway. And they're saying, fine, if you want to do that, you're going to forego this. And I was like, I can forego any amount of money. I don't care. I just want to see the D word in the Islamic version of the D word, like stamped on a paper, this is done. But they really, really ramped up their like harassment, whether like the police, my local police station, and then my ex-husband's like barrage of like abuse just kind of escalated. So I'd find like, you know, just things outside my house, and I was being followed and monitored and on my way to work and back. And he would show up at like, I think the Football World Cup was on. So I was watching England play with like all of my colleagues. And right in the middle of the game, one of my colleagues was like, Nouria, don't move, but we're just going to get up and we're going to leave because he's right there. And I'm like, it just got too much, Andrew. I was like, I can't even, like, I can't enjoy my days. I can't enjoy my nights. Oh my God. I can't sleep at night. And then the police started calling me like post 10 p.m. And on weekends, when, again, an Islamic country, they're not allowed to do that for a woman. So I'm trying to play them with their rules, you know, like you can only call me during these hours and things like that. But they kept demanding my passport. And I'm like, you don't need a passport to deal with like a civil divorce dispute. Do you know what I mean? And I obviously, I'm not like that naive. And I've heard all these stories about Brits in Dubai. I've heard what happens. And I know that the turning point, the pivotal factor, is handing over your passport. Because then you've essentially handed over control.
Yeah.
So when they kept asking for that, I was literally so done. And I was so deflated. I was on the verge of giving it. I was like, just take it, do whatever. And just before I was parked outside the police station to give it over, and the lawyer that was representing me, she went in, and in a like last ditch attempt, I made a call to like the British emergency number for expats, And I called, and thankfully this angel of a man answered, and I gave him like a 30-second rundown. I was like, hi, listen, I'm a British citizen. I'm an expat in Dubai. I've been married for this long, these are all the cases that they're trying to put against me. I'm just trying to file for divorce. I've got my passport, that they're asking for it now. And he's just like, okay, listen, like, do you have your passport in your hand still? And I said, yeah. He's like, do not go into that police station. Do you hear me? And I was like, okay. And he's like, I can't give you legal advice, but do not go into that police station and hand it over. And I was like, okay. He's like, how far are you from the airport? And I was like, not that far. Like, I could, he's like, if you could just pack basic things and just come home to where the stuff that they're even trying to put on you doesn't apply. And at the same time, Andrew, my lawyer ran out and she was like, no, you're not going to win anything here. Get out. They are charging you with all kinds of things that are like adultery and theft and all kinds of things that you could put out of thin air. But in Sharia things, they, according to Sharia punishments, they are like life imprisonment and like lashing, and the punishments are insane. We're dealing with barbaric punishments here.
You must have been in a panic.
Oh my God, yeah. That I would just literally got, like, I just put my foot down, went straight to the airport. Even then, Andrew, like walking in the airport, every time I had to scan my Emirates ID through a scanner, sometimes the scanner would make a big noise, and I was like, have they put a travel ban on me? Like, have they notified the whole airport? And my mother was just like, have the wheels left the runway? It was just a panic to get out of there.
And now you're back.
And now I'm back, thankfully, yeah. And it was having the space and downtime being back here. Because even living in the UAE, if I thought things were like just not making sense or something was off, I never had access to a free and open internet. I always had to go through VPN. And when I got back to England, processed, went to therapy for PTSD, had EMDR therapy, which was incredible. I would recommend that to anyone who's ever like gone.
What is that?
It's eye movement resensitization and deprocessing.
I've heard of that. Yeah, I've heard it's great, that.
Brilliant. I could not recommend that enough. Yeah. Like, Andrew, honestly, it's just wiped it from my mind. And when I got back to this country, every time I heard like a police siren, I would literally think they're coming for me. And I'd like, people would have to say, no, this is UK police. Like, there's nothing. That was in Dubai. You're here now. You're safe. The police here, like, you know, they're not going to do anything like that to you. But I was afraid of men. I was afraid of police sirens. And, you know, London's like ambulance, fire, all these things going off. So I couldn't leave the house for a very long time. And this just changed the game for me.
Wow. And now you've got a YouTube channel, which is doing really well.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's it's growing slowly but surely. Holy Humanist.
Okay. And what kinds of things are you putting out there?
It's basically I'm trying to verbatim show Islamic sources and scripture, especially what it means for the way it affects women in reality and children in reality. So I'm just trying to show people that, like, when I came back to the UK and I actually like applied my attention to be intellectually honest, to see what does the Quran say in my own language. Like, I'll just read it in English now. I'm not faffing around with Quraishi Arabic. Like, I'm done with that. I've done it three times in that language. So I just, as an adult and with a logical like mind, I read it. And people have access to the same information. As I was saying to you, like, if you just go on sunnah.com after this, when we were talking about, you know, Muhammad's married to Aisha, it's there. And don't get me wrong, they are trying to take these down and they're trying to censor it and they're trying to add parentheses and brackets and soften the blow and make it more palatable, but it's all there. So I'm just trying to show, like, just have women who can see the other side. It's predominantly aimed at women, but generally just like, it's basically my leaving Islam, what I found most problematic and why it's 100% man-made and really, really problematic for society. So I just interview people who have also left Islam from various beliefs, and then a little bit of the atheistic touch as well, just to also interview people who have deconverted from other religions.
I think that's fascinating. I think a lot of men as well will love going to your channel. So, but tell me this, who is a heretic you admire?
Obviously Hitchens has to be one, but Ricky Gervais. Oh. I love Ricky Gervais. I love his way of just, I've seen a stand-up when he just opens the Bible and he just starts reading it. And it's like, that's comedy in itself right there.
Because the serpent had legs back then or whatever. He says something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
He can walk, right?
Yeah. Oh, what a shame. We couldn't before, like, render to my belly.
That's great. And he takes his leg. Oh, that was it. It was taking the legs away. Yeah, that was, yeah, sorry, you're right. Yeah. He's like, oh no, oh, I've lost my legs. legs. Sorry, God.
Can't walk anymore, not that I used to.
Oh, that's great. Gervais follows this podcast's Twitter. So you might see you say that.
Oh my gosh.
Maybe I'll clip it and then he'll see it.
That would be epic. And Ricky, if you're listening, please give Islam a little bash in one of your next shows. Just a little bash.
Give it a bash. I think not a bash, as in a try, because then...
Oh, no.
Convert.
Chuck it under the
Ricky,
bus.
Ricky, give it a bash. Give it a go, Ricky. Convert to Islam. Just a little bash. I think he'll know what you mean.
Thank you, Nuria Khan, for being on the show. Nuria's absolutely brilliant. She's just so good at explaining so much of this stuff. I hope it makes a lot more sense to some of you now. It's certainly starting to, for me, as I say, it's this unholy alliance of oppression and silencing opposition thought. It's a scary thing, really, and hopefully something that will be better understood and better under control in the coming years. Please do follow Nuria on Holy Humanist, a wonderful YouTube channel that's doing really well now, and she's a really good speaker, so you can keep up to date with everything going on in that world on Holy Humanist. And spread this podcast around, support it on andrewgold.locals.com.